It's John 19. I'm going to read to you the first 16 verses. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They came up to him saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, "See, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters again and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. Now, it was the day of the preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold, your king." They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." So he delivered him over to them to be crucified. The passage in front of us raises two common, probably more, but at least two common questions asked about authority and about freedom. And those two things are tied together. Those with authority take our freedom, sometimes. At least we're told that they do by those claiming an alternative authority, without noting any irony in it. And the issues are to do with, what right do you have to say that? And it's funny, I was preparing this before all the BBC Sport fiasco started, but what right do you have to say that, or to stop me from saying that? What right do you have to tell me? And that could be a BBC Sports commentator. It could be a teacher, or a boss, or the police, or the government, or often the church. What right do you have? And related to that is my freedom, that my freedom must be paramount over everything. Now, peel back those issues between little power plays between people, or big power plays between them, lies a deeper issue, which is our power play with God, especially Jesus. What authority does he have? Do I have to listen to him? Has he come to take away my freedom? His authority clashing with my freedom. And so a question anyone would ask is, if I become a Christian, that is, if Jesus becomes my king, will I lose my freedom? Will I lose my life as I know it? Or if I am a Christian, for those of us who are Christians, am I missing out by being a Christian? Can I live in both camps? I've noticed this lately in pop culture. Whenever you have Christians and they have the various quirks, they say grace before their meals but have no sexual ethic. Can I live in both camps? Whatever, not necessarily that issue, but can I be a worldly Christian? Is that okay? And the question has been asked in many ways through the years, can we live without Jesus' authority? And the alternatives are pretty dreadful. One way or the other, they end up being oppressive. And those issues are come out in this reading. They come out of two things that Pilate says to the Jews. He says about Jesus, "Behold the man." And he says, "Behold the king." And then there's a conversation, or a few conversations, that run around those two things. Behold the man, behold the king. And the conversation around that gets to the heart of these issues of freedom and authority. So first, behold the man in verse 5. And in verses 1 to 6, the conversation is all about authority. Actually, running in beyond verse 6, actually. All about authority. Who has what authority? So the players here are Pilate and Rome, the Jews, and of course, Jesus. And who appears to have authority might not really have it. So Pilate has been placed in this position by Caesar, the most powerful man in the world over the Roman Empire. And Pilate acts on his behalf. Caesar has given him the authority of Caesar for that area. Officially, all power is his. But it's his because Rome says so. But through the chapter, you sort of wonder, well, is he feeling the power? Because the Jews are pushing on him, and the crowd ends up getting its own way. The Jews are really pulling his strings. It's a great example of power to the people. So Pilate has all the power, only if they let him. And of course, there's a third player, Jesus, with no power at all, clearly. Or maybe not. So verses 1 to 3, Pilate has Jesus beaten by the Roman soldiers. And they've been hearing these debates that have gone on about Jesus as king. And so they get a cloak, probably a Roman officer's cloak, that's sort of a kingly colour. And they take some thorns into some sort of makeshift crown, put it on his head, cutting his head. And they have this mock coronation. And you have before you this pathetic figure. And in verse 3 it says, they come up to him. And the phrase there, they come up to him, is a phrase they use for homage to a king. And the tense is that it's they keep coming up to him. But instead of bringing their gifts, they punch him. In the other Gospels, they beat him with a reed. It's like a kind of a cheap scepter. So they're mocking his kingship. King, okay, here's your scepter, smash him. Your majesty, here is our tribute, punch him. What kind of king is that? Clearly he's anything but a king, hence the mocking. And we start to get this image building up of Jesus in verses 4 and 5 that he's both innocent and pathetic. It seems that Pilate is deliberately doing this to set up a scene. He doesn't want to kill Jesus because he's innocent, so he roughs him up. For non-English people here, that's an understatement. They rough him up. He looks pathetic. He looks unkingly. And so the Jews will just drop it. And he states in verse 4, he is innocent. There is no guilt in him. We covered that last week. Verse 5, he's also pathetic. So Jesus came out wearing a crown of thorns and a purple robe. Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Behold the man is a loaded term. In one sense, he's just saying, look at the man. Look at the accused. But it seems Pilate is saying more. He's mocking the Jews. Behold the man, the one that's troubled you so much you want him dead. Look at him. The man that troubles your national security. The man who's undermining your religion. Look, behold the pathetic individual. Really, how pathetic that this man is troubling you so. But also, it's one of Jesus' favorite terms, the Son of Man. And the Son of Man is an Old Testament term that means a man or a human. But also, it means the promised one, the Savior, one who comes like a Son of Man. And what John has gone to enormous lengths to show us over his gospel is that Jesus is God and man. He is God clothed in humanity, God come as a man. He is fully God, he's fully man. He's the most human man there has been. And so this is another example that we keep on getting in John of when someone speaks better than they know. So Pilate is showing that he has power over the Jews. He's mocking the Jews, but Jesus is showing power over them both. He is the man. He is truly human. He is the promised Son of Man. And on hearing, behold the man, their response to the declaration of the crowd, crucify. But just who is it that they are speaking of? Well, the same dynamic plays out in verses 6 to 11. So in verses 6 to 7, the issue is, who has authority here? Pilate or the Jews? Pilate says, go and crucify him yourself then. Oh yeah, you can't because you don't have the authority, because I'm the governor and you're not. Although they could stone him. And their reply is mocking back. We have a law, unlike you, God's law. Jesus is blaspheming. He's saying that he's the Son of God. And so we have another power struggle. Who's really got the power here? The majority or the governor? And Pilate responds to fear. Now, the fear seems to be, I think it's superstitious, because in Roman religion, it's all about God's walking among us. It seems that Romans probably didn't believe a lot of their religion, but it was a way of explaining the world. But he's now going, okay, so in our religion, in our stories, the gods sometimes walk among us, and sometimes the gods have sons with human women. Have I got one in my office? So he questions Jesus, who is he? And infuriatingly, Jesus ignores him. And Pilate's not used to people ignoring him, and he points out the seriousness. Don't you realize, Jesus, that I have the power of life and death? That's me. I've got the power of life and death over you. And you're playing games. Verse 11, Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. And now we see where true power lies. The power struggle between Roman rule, raw political power, and the power of the masses. And Jesus has authority over both. Jesus says the only authority is from God, and it's seen in him. Pilate only has power because God has lent it to him. And the same is true of Caesar and of the high priests and anyone else. And it's true of any power, and it's true of any power today. All authority is Christ's. Now, he delegates power. We have this idea of common grace, that because of God's graciousness to everyone, there's some order in the world. So we have policemen, and we have our politicians, and you have your boss at work. They all have authority, but only that God has lent them. And all of that power is fallen, it's fallible, it's usually a bit corrupt. And all of it is accountable to Jesus. So first glance, what we see is this image is pathetic, that Jesus is standing there, he's bleeding and bruised, he's beaten, he's dressed as this ridiculous mock king. But behold the man. We're not for a moment to think, poor Jesus. I mean, when I read the Passion narratives in all four Gospels, it's deeply moving. It is deeply moving. And yes, he's innocent, and yes, he is suffering. But we've also seen the last couple of weeks that he is in control. He goes to the cross because he wants to go to the cross. And it raises that question again. Who is judging who? There is a power struggle here, but the real power is in front of them. And that power in front of them, that pathetic figure, is actually also above them. And he is weighing up you too. We think that we're judging what we think about Jesus. He's actually judging and weighing up you. Behold the man. And then behold your king, verse 14. And these verses are about true freedom, and true freedom from tyranny in verses 12 to 18. And so there's an irony here, but we see it played out everywhere. And every day we see people playing out what's going on here and forfeiting freedom. Jesus is rejected as king because I don't want anyone, including him, over me. And we're all like that. We don't want his authority. We don't want Jesus controlling what we do and don't do. But the alternative is a far worse form of tyranny. So Pilate is not inclined to send Jesus to the cross, but the Jews make him afraid. So he ends up doing it anyway. So in verse 12, from then on Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." So Rome conquered different territories, and they put a governor in charge. And they, depending on the region, there was a certain degree of self-rule, some less so than others. And the Jews had complained about the governors over them before. Now, if you notice anything about Caesars, I don't know much, but what I know is that the Caesars were paranoid. And they were understandably paranoid because most Caesars became Caesars by killing their predecessor. Therefore, they're worried about who's going to kill them to take the job. And so anyone who is not enthusiastically loyal to them, often, more often than not, get killed, just in case. And so a complaint from a province that a governor is not cracking down on someone pretending to be king could have pretty serious consequences. So initially Pilate's like, "Well, you and whose army? Well, a little complaint to Caesar about there's another king that you've allowed to rise to the surface. It could be pretty serious." So this makes Pilate afraid. And he goes to the judgment throne. And Jesus' fate is sealed. Now, in some ways, Pilate has lost his argument, hasn't he? He's lost his argument with the Jews, but he can't resist another dig at them. And so he sits in his judgment seat, sending Jesus to the cross, and he says, "Behold your king," verse 14. Again, he's mocking them, isn't he? He's saying, "Is this the best you can do? And I have authority to put him to the cross. You Jews, at the end of the day, make a big noise, but you're not as powerful as I am." And their response to that is remarkable. In verse 15, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, 'Shall I crucify your king?' The chief priests answered, 'We have no king but Caesar.'" We have no king but Caesar. When offered their king, there are two striking responses. Away and crucify. The ultimate violent rejection. When God came into the world wanted him dead. That's the first one. The second one is, "We have no king but Caesar." Now just let that sink in for a moment. We have no king but Caesar. They're not merely rejecting their promised king, but they're substituting him for another. Only Caesar is our king. Now think about what that meant for them. And when we think about what it meant for them, there's an uncomfortable link to us. Caesar ruled the Roman Empire. He invaded Judea. That's the promised land. I mean, Russia and Ukraine upsets us, and rightly. But this is even more serious in some ways because it's the promised land. It's God's land. And the promised land is meant to be ruled by a king in the line of David. None of that's happening. It's been promised by God, it's been ripped from them by one nation after another, it's now the Romans. And what Caesar did is he divided up the land, in this case between Herod and Pilate, who have some authority. Roman soldiers would be walking on the street and would tell you what's what. They could just say, you could be doing your job, getting about your business, and they just say, "Carry this stuff for a couple of miles for me," or whatever it is. Locals were appointed as tax collectors, who are extorting wealth out of you. This is not a good situation to be in, and in many other ways. But they would rather have that than Jesus. Only Caesar is our king. They'd prefer a tyrant, a bully, to the Prince of Peace. But the same's going on today. In every heart and mind, rejecting Jesus or struggling to live with Jesus under his rule, because, you know, no one's going to call the shots in my life. But in the end, we're not neutral. Self-governance would be bad enough. If it were just me saying, "I'm rejecting Jesus, I'm going to rule me," that would be bad enough, with some serious consequences. But rather we turn to Caesar. We turn to spiritual and emotional tyrants. Now, have you noticed, you know, over the years you watch the news and there's a military coup? And you understand why they would have a coup, because of the governance. But they're always replaced by someone more tyrannical. Now, someone's going to come up with an exception now. But by and large, the people who violently claim authority are more tyrannical than those who they were liberating everyone from. And something like that happens in our hearts. Bob Dylan said, you've got to serve someone. You've got to serve someone. And Jesus, when he's not there, the void is filled, and it's always filled by a tyrant. Let's think of a few. Addictions. Booze, porn, food, various other things. Or false gods. Take, for example, money. And money is a bit like Pilate. It actually works for another god behind it, that of security. If we need to serve money, we bear the wrath of security when we get it wrong. Acceptance of others, because you wouldn't want to be weird, would you? Wouldn't that be the worst thing ever, to be a weirdo? Various good things that can go on can become a god as well. Being a good mum or dad or a good student or a good worker. I suggest they're all good things we should try to do. But they are tyrants when they replace Jesus. And they are brutal tyrants. Unforgiving, ungracious tyrants. Because when you fail them, and you will, on the day that you are a bad dad, which will happen, or bad husband, or whatever you are, there is no forgiveness and there is no mercy. The various false gospels, we'll think about these tonight, the sort of distortions, sometimes subtle distortions of Christianity. All our spiritual and emotional tyrants have no grace, no forgiveness, and they oppress us. And that's what you want instead of Jesus. That's what you opt for when you fear Jesus taking the reins. But what does King Jesus give you? The one we fear, what does he give us? Freedom. Now, why do I say that? Why do I say Jesus gives us freedom? Look at the start of verse 14. Now, it was the day of the preparation of the Passover. All this happens at the time of the Passover. Now, we noticed this last time. We noticed it a while back, actually, that all these events are framed at the time of the Passover. Now, that would be enough, but John keeps on doing it. It was a time... Did I tell you it was the time of the Passover? Do you remember that it's the time of the Passover? He keeps on repeating the time of the Passover. John thinks it matters. Now, what is the Passover about? It's about freedom from tyranny. You know the story. Israel were in Egypt. They were slaves under a tyrant, Pharaoh. He'd bound them to put them to hard labor. And there's a contest then between Pharaoh and God of who can save their son. And as you know, at the Passover, the angel of death goes over the whole land of Egypt. And in every house in Egypt, there was a death. For the Egyptians, the death of the firstborn. For Israel, the Passover lamb died instead of the firstborn. There's a death, but it's not the firstborn in their house. And the angel passes over. When he sees the blood of the lamb on the doorpost, the angel passes over. And we keep on being reminded that these events are at the Passover, because John has already shown us that Jesus is the real Passover lamb. And that's not a weird John thing. All the Gospels, all the New Testament writers at some point identified Jesus as the real Passover lamb. Again, his innocence, a lamb without blemish. And so there we were thinking that Jesus was on trial, but Jesus is controlling and he is opting to go to the cross as a silent Passover lamb to the slaughter. He died so that God's righteous judgment passes over us and it falls on him instead, so that you can be free and free from those tyrants. And the ultimate tyrants of death and the devil. There's a hymn we sometimes sing, has this line, be of sin the double cure, save me from wrath and make me pure. So it saves us from the wrath that's to come, from his own justice, so we don't face that future. But also saves us from the slavery of sin now. Because like in Exodus, when they were en route to the promised land, you know the story, on the way from Egypt to the promised land, what do? They moan. And they go, oh, they don't have cucumber. And of course we find it hysterical. Well, they've been freed from slavery, but they're moaning about cucumber. But that's us, isn't it? When presented, here you have freedom or slavery with cucumber, and natural response is, I have to think about it. It's what we're like. We're just like addicted to tyrants and tyranny. And so here, behold your king. Behold your king. Is it Jesus or a Caesar? You have to serve someone. Christ or some brutal tyrant of your choosing. Behold the man. Behold your king. Consider who he is. Behold the man. He is the man. All authority is his. He has all rights, including over you. He is not judged. He is judging. As you weigh him, he is weighing you. And behold your king. He is a king, but he is the king who died as the Passover lamb to set you free. When you give up your individualism, your independence, your self-rule, and crown him in your heart, only then do you start to experience freedom. Behold the man. Behold your king.